Hurra, hurra! Ein Design-Podcast der Burg.
Hello and welcome to Hurra Hurra Podcast by Burg-Giebichenstein University of Arts and Design. We have a wonderful guest here today, Valentina Kager.
Hello.
We are recording today in Berlin from Valentina's home in Moabit. Mm-hmm. My name is Anna Unterstab. I'm an artistic teaching assistant for information design here at Burg, and I'm hosting this episode as the final one of a series of three looking at design from an intersectional lens with people who want to rethink design as a tool for change and as a tool to change the status quo into a more just world. But we will also exchange about the difficulties and hardships we face on this journey, and this sounds quite big and abstract, but we will untangle this more in the following hour with Valentina. So welcome, Valentina. I'm so happy to have you here with me.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Anna.
So I'm going to introduce Valentina's practice. Valentina was born in Chalkidiki in northern Greece and lives here in Berlin. And she was a professor for the initiation of artistic work in design at HFBK in Hamburg for the last 6 years. This is also where we met. And as an architect by training, her artistic practice creates work across different media and work that draws on the investigative potential of arts and design, as well as the applied nature of design. In her socially engaged art practice, she works with so-called simulations, where she invites a public or a community to complete the work with her, for example, by building prototypes in a DIY manner. And in such hands-on processes of doing, making, learning, and talking, they end up imagining alternatives for infrastructures and institutions that structure our reality. Those simulations are reflected on in different media by Valentina, for example, through research blogs or events and publications. And I personally find your design practice very special and unique. It's so research-based, and it also includes different theories and like from different fields like philosophy or biology. And it also focuses a lot on storytelling and speculation, which is very rare in this like border between design and architecture and art. And also I'm impressed by your participatory processes and the situatedness of your practice and how your work is related to ecology and the connections of humans and nature, if you even want to separate those two terms. So sometimes we hear Valentina's two baby cats on the back meowing.
Yeah.
You kind of want to talk to us today as well.
They are learning to vocalize.
But not only in your artworks, but also your teaching, I see this motive to encourage people to question the status quo and also become self-aware and active to really activate them. So Valentina, you may move between the borders of art, design and architecture, and maybe also crafts. Can you tell me a bit more what those categories actually mean for you, and if those split into different terms makes sense still today, or if we should throw this disciplinary thinking under the bus?
Yeah, I wish we could throw it under the bus, but we can't. So I think we have to work with it rather than to be completely against it. The separation of the craft and design is something that interests me a lot, and mm-hmm. that I have been thinking about it since when we started extracting the design out of the craft, because in my opinion and in my understanding, it's all one combined thing. And I think this had to do with the process of becoming more industrialized, separating the act of designing something and the act of making something. And I'm very interested in bringing this back together. And I also do a lot of the production with my hands. I don't really outsource it to other companies to do the production for me. First and foremost, because they can't, because it's all crafts that I invent. So there is no really company that is trained in how to dye textiles naturally. You know, in contemporary capitalist system, there is no companies or craftspeople who know how to do things with natural materials, because all this is craft that comes from a long time ago that has been somehow lost. And about art and design and architecture, especially art and architecture, because my background is in architecture, I'm a little bit always in between these categories. People from the art world see me as an architect, and people from the architecture world see me as an artist. So nobody can really place me. Mm-hmm. And I cannot really place myself, and I really don't care about this. I'm interested in what I'm interested in. I'm very much interested in the topic of infrastructure, for example, that still links me to architecture in a content way, but not so much in the forms and building vocabulary of architecture, for example. So I'm very much interested in very similar topics, but not than like people in the realm of architecture or design mm-hmm. are talking about, but I approach them from a completely different position and a completely different way of building and working with materials around it.
This can also be a strong side to not be so easily placeable, that you have this flexibility and can shift, and people don't have the most concrete expectations to you and your practice.
Yeah, this shape-shifting is interesting to me in general, to be this kind of shape-shifter entity. Mm-hmm. But it's not so much about the expectations, it's because I think we all have common goals, and we need to work together beyond the disciplines for a common future. And it doesn't matter what your expertise or what you contribute to this. Mm-hmm. We have to find a vocabulary and a language to talk transdisciplinary and still make sense to one another and understand our alliances and what we can contribute from its one's perspective on it.
And also, I realized recently that this separation, especially between art, design and craft, is also kind of a new one if you look back into history for longer. As you also said, but it's not only about industrialization, but also a tool of colonial power structure and oppression. Do you also reflect on this when you place yourself in disciplines or in your work directly?
Yeah, definitely. But more from an embodied perspective. I just want to do things differently. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if I feel this oppression on my body when I start thinking, okay, in which category this could fit or where I could contextualize this work better. Like it has some certain, yeah, kind of a power play or this structure in it that I feel immediately the oppression in my body. So I almost feel what you're saying instead of like theorizing about it. Mm-hmm. But it makes total sense.
For me, it came up recently more when I designed an exhibition in Hamburg and Mark Museum about the Sapmi culture and some people and their crafts and arts. And it was a lot of objects who have been collected in a colonial context, since the Sami peoples are the last native peoples who live in the north of Europe, in Norway, Sweden, Finland and parts of Russia. And they have specific crafts which they do for thousands of years already, and some of those objects were collected by the museum in the beginning of the 20th century, which was a very colonial time, especially in Hamburg. And those objects should be displayed in the exhibition and were combined with contemporary artist positions by all female amazing Sami artists. And it was a challenge for us to do this exhibition design because we wanted to present them on one level and not make a big difference between a contemporary artwork and a piece of craft. But usually if they are shown together, they will have different labels, like there will be separations. And so we were really thinking about how the labels for all of those exhibition texts and also the historic information will look and how we can like really present them on an equal way, even if some of them are 300 years old and some are very contemporary and they have different dimensions. But it was really interesting to see that this is a border or boundary which has been created and is not a real one. Mm-hmm. And also Dori Tunstall is talking about this in her book, Decolonizing Design, which I really can recommend and will put into the show notes if you want to know more about the separation. She's writing about it from an ethnography perspective.
Yeah. No, this sounds really fascinating. And maybe to add a little bit to this whole discussion. To me, it's really crazy today that people cannot afford good craftsmanship. For instance, in product design or in furniture design, there is a lot of things that are built with a very bad craftsmanship. These are the most affordable things that you see in people's homes. And the actual craftsmanship is super expensive and it's considered a luxury thing. While back in the day, craftsmanship was just to know how to do things well and to appreciate the everyday objects that help you, you know, give you all these freedoms you have in your everyday life with these tools and objects. And now we mostly buy things that break down all the time, and this is still cheaper to buy this fossil fuel based cheap stuff with bad craftsmanship rather than to buy one and good thing that is made with good craftsmanship and good maybe non-fossil based materials.
Yeah, I'm also thinking about that a lot of objects who are made with craftsmanship maybe locally are advertised with this label of being handmade, but actually most objects are still handmade. But when they're made in the global south, in places we don't see, they kind of become more anonymous, but still someone made them, but probably under very precarious ways of working. So then, of course, the craftsmanship can't be as good. And yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So it's like all it very twisted, and that the craftsmanship is really, it has lost its appeal. You know, it's almost like a folklore thing instead of high contemporary art or design, which I think is very sad, and it has to do with all these power plays from historical colonialism and this kind of contemporary colonialism, what you described of things produced in the shadowlands of the global south.
Yes. Let's see how you incorporate this understanding for crafts as well in your teaching. But first, we want to talk about your artistic practice. So your work is very varied and full of a big range of topics and techniques. And you often work collectively and site-specific, and use biodegradable materials and some ancient techniques. And I think it really makes sense to dive into your practice directly now to make it less abstract. And I would love to talk to you about this work of yours, the Wellbeings exhibition you had in Museum for Kunst und Gewerbe in Hamburg recently in 2023. Because I also saw this exhibition and I really liked it. And it's an interactive installation about climate anxiety. And in this exhibition, visitors could confront their feelings, worries and fears about the climate crisis due to these immediate consequences of the climate change. More and more people today suffer from chronic fear of doom. And this fear is also accompanied by feelings of helplessness, anger and guilt, and can lead to chronic pain, panic attacks, nervousness, sleeping disorders and even depression. How do you deal with this topic? I think I saw somewhere that you also came up with this topic because of your personal experiences.
Yes. First of all, since we're going into this exhibition, Wellbeings, I just want to quickly say that for people who haven't seen it, it's going to travel now soon in Staatsgalerie Saarbrücken.
Ah, nice.
Opening November 8th. So come to Saarbrücken to see the show and to really actually experience the show.
Mm-hmm.
But coming back, to climate anxiety, it is still a really big topic for me. And since I came out to openly acknowledge that I had climate anxiety, I still have it. It just doesn't distort my everyday life so much as it did for a period of time. More and more people say, oh, me too, I also have all these feelings. So it's very useful to put out, to talk openly about our feelings.
Yes.
And my personal struggle with it is that for a long time I didn't realize that I have all these feelings and they became so big and they took over my life because I thought that I shouldn't have them. I thought that it's a crazy response.
So you pushed it away for
So I was trying to push it away and try not to acknowledge it, try to behave normally, because somehow all this pressure from the climate denialist culture that we live today is there, and it is really real, and it produces a narrative saying, oh, you're crazy, you're hysteric, you are too, you know, this is too much to have all these feelings about the collapse of the climate and the world as we know it, because actually there is no climate change. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and everybody's so confused about it. And it took me a while to say, no, actually, I have the appropriate response about this. Yeah. And you have the weird response. You know, it's not the denial is the problem and not the reality of going through all this anger, through all this, also guilt, because as we know, climate change is also caused by humans, or mainly caused by humans, and grief about all this loss of biodiversity and species and all the things we're losing, all the forests we're losing every year with on the fires. So this is the appropriate response to have, and I'm so glad I sorted it out, because it also changed my relationship to the climate anxiety. I have it, I feel it, yeah, of course I have it, you know, it's weird not to have it. And it doesn't disturb my sleep anymore, or I came out of that kind of depression, that this no kind of false cycle put me in.
Did it also help you to manually work on this pieces for the exhibition to come out of this anxiety? Yeah, I can imagine that it really helps to also activate the body and come back from your mind.
Yeah, definitely. And this exhibition is a lot about treating the anxiety with embodied therapy, somehow, like somatic. I think in contemporary terms it's called somatic psychotherapy, to understand how your nervous system can get destabilized, and that you cannot come back from fight or flight back to rest and digest easily. Mm-hmm. And this is a mechanism that happens in the body, and you also have to address it back into the body and do things that relax you. Yeah, you have to build some after you figure out what's going on with your mind and that you are good to feel these emotions, then you really have to have some patience until the body builds back its homeostasis.
And for this, it helps you also to do crafty activities and work on textiles?
Yes, absolutely. Like, I really went into learning how to work with the natural dyes in this period of my life.
It sounds a bit like a meditative process as well. You also collect some of the plants you use for this yourself.
Exactly.
Then they have to dry, probably. So it's a timey process.
Yes, it's not as fast, and that's why I was explaining before there are no companies to dye things with plants, because it's much faster to dye it with chemical dyes. This, apart from the collection, which actually you can find quite a lot of natural dyes online, for there is a market, so you don't have to handpick everything yourself if you don't have the time.
Yes.
Or if you don't have the accessibility. But to also process the dyes and process the fabrics, they take different steps, because you have to open the pores of the fabric for the dyes to go in. So it's not something you just do, you have a result immediately. Maybe it takes a couple of days to really finish a piece, or even more. Depends what you want to do, of course.
I'm just realizing that our listeners, how this exhibition looked, they don't know what the topic was, but I'm going to describe a bit what I saw when I went through this exhibition. So I went into a very dark room first, and there was all the walls, there was hanging white fabric. This really changed the look of it and the atmosphere, and then there was really not a lot of light and no daylight. But in the middle of it, there was a lot of textile sculptures, very fluffy, kind of plushy-ish objects with arms. Some of them had like human shapes or looked a bit like animals, very soft. And people were taking off their shoes and then cuddling with those elements, laying on top of them, hugging them, yeah, maybe even falling asleep for a little nap. And I was very impressed to see that this actually worked in a museum, because I sometimes feel like there might be elements like this, places where you can rest or touch things, but sometimes people are still afraid. And this aura of the museum and this untouchableness and how objects are valued doesn't really go away. But in your case, people really went for it and spent a lot of time there, and this was really nice to see. And those objects were made from fabrics in different colors, and then there was also sofa elements. There was elements which you can put on top of yourself. And then in the next room there was a video installation and some anciently looking figures, female looking figures exhibited, and also a mural of yours. Did I forget anything? Was this like a right overview?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more or less. Should I elaborate more?
Mm-hmm, please.
Yeah, so the exhibition was organized in these two rooms, and I was also very happy with how well it worked with the participation of people.
Mm-hmm.
People were very immediately drawn to taking off their shoes and diving into the soft sculptures. Maybe I have to explain the two layers of this work. The first layer is my research with these prehistoric figurines of the MKG's antiquities collection, that I was actually researching them before I even realized that some of them are there at the MKG.
You started in Finland in another project, right?
Not in Finland.
Okay.
I started in Singapore.
Ah, okay.
In a research project I was doing there. But a lot of them actually, they come from the country that is contemporarily my country, Greece. But this is how I knew of them at first place, because I had seen them in archaeological museums in Greece. But then I realized that all across the world in this similar era of the Neolithic times, there is similar figurines that resemble human beings with clearly female characteristics. So there's a lot of breasts and vulvas very expressively. But what is not so much talked about is the animal characteristics of these figurines. And this is what caught my attention. It's like, okay, everybody acknowledges that they are some kind of women or female, but actually to me they look like very animalistic, like a lot of them had bird faces or other kind of animals that you cannot really say which animals exactly. And then I delved into the work of the very contested archaeologist Maria Gimbutas, who put in the 60s and the 70s this theory out that these sculptures come from a matrilineal past, so they are all women, because back then the people were believing in Great Mother Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course, it did that during the 70s, which was second wave of feminism going on. And in these ways, it contributed to the second wave of feminism, of giving the women back then a matriarchal past to look up to.
Mm-hmm.
But today, I'm much more interested in the post-human turn and the planetary turn. And with this thinking in mind, I wanted to also create a speculative theory that contributes more to the post-human, which is for me, it's the ultimate abolition of otherness, because it understands not only other humans, women or people of color or people with different bodies, but also even animals as part of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like these animal characteristics of these figurines. And this is then the shapes I took, and I transformed them into the sofa, into the hugging pillows. They were also body warmers, parts of these animal aspects of the figurines that you could put into the microwave, get them warm, and then wear them yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So you would kind of become yourself this kind of, how I like to call them, prehistoric post-human.
Mm-hmm.
So this was one aspect about why the forms that I chose, and then the other aspect is why it's about why I chose the particular design objects to work with. So sofas and hugging pillows and the body warmers I just explained. There was also a weighted blanket, which is all products to help you deal with anxiety. So a weighted blanket puts a lot of weight on your body, and it's somehow this acupressure, the body calms down for fight or flight, because if you have a lot of weight on your body, you cannot suddenly stand and start running, right?
Yeah, let's briefly say something about fight and flight. This is modes the body can switch into automatically when it's threatened. So it's a trauma response, but it can also happen in everyday life when we're afraid of something.
Yeah, it's like a very ancient nervous system mechanism we have that made us survive as species. Yeah, so when there was a big bear chasing us as humans, we would have to run away from it or learn how to fight with it in order to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And this is still a built-in mechanism that can be very useful in situations to recognize danger. But if it kind of activates out of the blue, as it happens with cases of anxiety, it's a disturbance that you have to learn how to switch off, and you don't know how, right? And there are tricks how to do this bodily, but of course you also have to solve it as an understanding what you are trying to run away off from and how you can stop doing that. Yeah. Or what you're trying to fight. And I have to say that I was very critical of all these objects, because I was like, oh yeah, capitalism is again trying to solve this very difficult, unsolvable topic through producing and selling more objects.
Yeah.
You know, so... But then I tried the weighted blanket myself, and I have to say that I really liked it. And it really did help me sleep better. Mm-hmm. So I have this kind of critical loving relationship with these objects that I present in the exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think, you know, before I was very much, we don't need more chairs. Why do we make more and more and more things? But actually inventing objects is part of our human expression.
Mm-hmm.
And inventing tools. And I think it's still very important, actually.
Yeah.
So it made me soften up my idea, even about that. My very anti-capitalist ideas about design.
Well, I think your work is still anti-capitalist and also radical. But also this aspect of speculation is very much incorporated in those figures, I think, and also especially in your video where you walk around with this, I wasn't sure, is it the original ancient
figurines? Of course not.
Or did you like make your own reproductions or like own figures who are inspired by the originals? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were observing how they changed, how you behaved having them with you.
Yeah, I was having them with me as a reminder of who I want to believe I really am, that I'm a conglomerate of human and nature. So I try to really remember my animal nature within me and get them as little companions that remind me of that. How can I be with this acknowledgement? How can I be differently in this world? And this is what I wish that we will all reach to as human beings. You know, maybe we will not find very clear answers, but just to put this question to ourselves, I think it's very important.
Also from a design theory perspective, this is interesting because I feel like it's a contemporary upgrade for this idea of critical design and the techniques of working with probes, which to my knowledge Fiona Raby and Anthony Dunn have invented in the 2000s, and this idea of like critical design objects which don't need an immediate function, and to place them in someone's life just as a form of observation first, and then see critical design as an antidote to affirmative design, which is affirming the world we live in and the status quo, and then to question this by objects and processes which seem very abstract maybe at first, but then in the end have concrete functions and changes also with the people who live or work with them.
Absolutely, yeah, you're very right in this, and I really appreciate the work they do with the critical or speculative design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it goes a little bit in this direction, this kind of work. And all my work has speculative design elements for sure.
Let's also talk more about this aspect of critical self-care. Mm-hmm. Because I agree with you that this is a real problem that capitalism has again so quickly kind of taken away this term from us and chewed it out. And I kind of don't want to let it go because, as you know, and probably also our listeners now already know, that I relate a lot on feminist theory and living practice, and especially Black feminism is super important for us today. The Black poet and activist Audre Lorde has already in, I think in the 80s, talked about self-care extensively when she got cancer. And for her, it's really a form of survival and a weapon for marginalized bodies. And it's not like just bubble bath and weighted blankets, but really a radical everyday practice. She said, "Caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it is self-preservation. And that is an act of political warfare." So, yeah, as she described, self-care really plays a big role in the lives of marginalized and intersectionally marginalized people to survive in a marginalized body in everyday life. And at the Audre Lorde Project on their website, I read that this can also be transferred into community care, not just self-care, but also community care. And they said, "We must support each other's wellness." And I think this also really relates to this project of your The Well-Beings, and maybe also to your practice to not only focus on the self, but really also on the collective and the community aspect of care. And I would love to hear your thoughts on this, how you incorporate this into your artistic practice.
Yeah, first of all, I think we're a little bit lost in the way we're looking for care, in a way we think it looks like, without knowing what it feels like. So to look for that. So we're looking into all these products and images that we see through social media of how we think it will be if we're taking care of ourselves. And this is this very image-oriented culture that we have that is producing this. And the actual self-care, it's not about feeling good all the time. It's about making space to process emotions that can be very difficult or very unpleasant or uncomfortable. And how to make space to do this also together and not to make it one's own business, which I think it's very much like this nowadays. This is the actual work that we have to do. As I said in the beginning, I actually decided openly to talk about my own depression from climate anxiety in order to put this on the table and say, hey, you know, I'm not afraid to tell this about myself, and why should we? It's again a very neoliberal, patriarchal thing to do, to keep it behind closed doors. And I think we have to speak openly about mental health in very much also in regards with all the injustices that are being done in this world. The amount of people that are suffering, if you see it in numbers, is breaking records every year more and more and more. So this is not a personal thing. This is a societal mm-hmm. problem, and we have to address it collectively.
Mm. The individualization-based culture.
Yes. Yeah. It's again a gaslighting mechanism, putting this to ourselves and making you feel alone, unsupported, guilty that you brought this upon yourself. It's again this thing that we need to stand against for and to fight for. You know, another Lorde knew this. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was coming from a very different background, but she put it very nicely, and it's still a weapon to really talk about self-care and to practice self-care and to take back all the things that this world is stripping away from us that we need. Most of it is acknowledgement that we are right to feel how we feel.
But I think in a lot of moments, actually what I need is not to only focus on myself and process. I think this is a super important aspect you mentioned, but also to co-regulate with others. And as you said, to not feel alone anymore with my problems, my feelings, my experiences, but to come back to community, to other people, to see this less in an individual, but more in a society-based or structural level. And then find ways to be loving to each other, to still collect the energy to try to change the system.
Absolutely, and that's why in the exhibition there is also there is areas where you can hug yourself, the cushions, and there is areas where you can also hug with each other, the cushions. Because what you just said also makes sense from a bodily perspective. The body, the nervous system can self-regulate, but it can also co-regulate with connecting with other people's nervous system. And this is how we learn to regulate as babies. Also, our nervous system, we learn it from our primary caretakers. So it absolutely makes sense, not only politically, but also very practically, in the sense that we have a material body we live in.
This is an aspect I really like about your work, and especially this exhibition, that it's not an either or, but this way of regulation and physical focus of this exhibition is just one way. And then there's also other ways, like demonstrating against laws who are bad for the climate. I feel like you're not trying to tell us the one way or the one medicine how to deal with this issue, but there's several ones, and you're making an example and inviting people into this one tool to deal with this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really believe that we need more activism, and we need to really protest and say no, and to try to make demands about what we know that we need to facilitate this change that is super necessary to happen. But how can you do that when you really don't have any, you know, when you're deeply depressed or you're really deeply disturbed from this, you know? So this is like, it's meant for people that are really deeply so disturbed that they cannot go out and join the outwards fight.
To regain energy first.
Yes, to regain or put things in a different perspective. It's not about, oh, now I take a pause and I regain my energy. That is important too, but this is really about understanding that you're not the problem, that we are correct to feel how we feel, and taking some time to process all this, and hopefully then finding your way in how to join back the rest of the struggle. Yeah, so it's not absolutely one way, or it, you know, everything should exist simultaneously. Actually, my next work, I think it will go more into the direction that you were just describing, but it's too soon to say anything right now.
Very exciting. Yeah. So we all have to follow Valentina and check out her next works.
Yeah.
You also at some point told me about a book which is putting this mechanisms of climate change denial into context.
I'm reading it now, I haven't finished it, but it's a very enlightening book that I highly recommend. It's called White Skin, Black Fuel, or Black Fuel, White Skin. And it's from Andreas Malm and the Zetkin Collective. And basically they are describing how racism and climate denialism is entangled with one another, and how climate denialism came to be, you know, like that, how it was kind of first invented by the oil industry, and then after it started failing there, how it got picked up by the radical left and it got reused and put into this context together with racism, and now it actually works again as a thing that many people are drawn to believe into. there is actually what they believe into is that there is no climate change, and if it is, it's not anthropogenic, so it's not our fault, it would happen anyway. And actually all the CO2 we're releasing from burning the fossil fuels is good because CO2 is life and trees need it. This is, for me, a real problem that we have for the first time in modern history, to not where people break away from the truth, the science, not the truth. You know, because truth is always an interpretation, but mm-hmm. from the scientific facts of measuring CO2 in the atmosphere and knowing what it does, and, you know, like, to not take that as a commonly agreed reality, as a basis to start talking with each other, is very problematic. And this book really describes this processes very well, and I find it super enlightening.
Thank you for this recommendation. This question of how we can live well together in our current age of uncertain futures with many crises happening at the same time seems to span through all your work. And I think this is really one of the biggest potentials about art, design, and maybe also architecture, that all of those disciplines can help us to imagine and also make visible alternative futures, and even take part in building them at some point, hopefully. So I see a hopeful aspect in all of this. And when we already talked about Audre Lorde and Black feminism, like, this motive of hope becomes very important. And I would like to know what this means for you in your practice.
I mean, this idea of helping me, us, everybody, create a different imagination of the future is very important to me. And I'm a bit even cautious with the word alternative nowadays, because it's co-opted by the radical right, you know, the alternative für Deutschland. So it's very interesting how we're playing ping-pong with the same terms. But what I mean with a different future is breaking away from this vision of an apocalyptic world. And this really dominates the common imagination, and we see it in a lot of popular culture spaces. And mm-hmm. I'm really sick of it, really bored. It's been going on for ages and nothing changes, and I'm like, why can't we imagine something different, you know? Like, maybe what we have to imagine is a really boring future.
Okay, interesting.
And I was very happy to read recently another book that I'm just recommending now. It's called How Infrastructure Works mm-hmm. by Deb Chakra, who is an engineer. And she really describes how infrastructure works and how this transition to a post-fossil fuel world could happen by transitioning to unlimited solar energy that we have, and stop extracting more and more fossil fuels for energy reasons. And if we have access to an unlimited source of energy, then the energy will also become cheap, and through that we will also be able to recycle and reuse materials better. So mm-hmm. nowadays, you know, when we're thinking, oh, if we need to convert everything to solar, what about with all these solar panels that don't work as well after so many years, or the batteries? This is other materials to be extracted from the earth. And we have to do this, we have to manage the post-fossil fuel transition, and simultaneously making sure that we will end up in the same problem with the extraction of other rare earths or things like that. Mm-hmm. And she gave me a lot of hope by saying, yeah, this is possible when we have unlimited energy, because all these things are done, they just need a lot of energy. And energy nowadays, because it's based on this limited resource, is expensive. So this is why it doesn't economically make sense for the industry to do so. And if we would transition to that, it would make economically sense. Yeah, and she gave me this idea of this really boring future of, like, I'm seeing a future where we will all have enough energy and enough material. We will just have to spend a lot more time in taking care and maintaining and mm-hmm. recycling, which is all unsexy things, you know. It's much more sexy to extract new things and produce new stuff, right? also in design, we all want to work with making a new chair or a new object and not like recycle an old one.
Mm-hmm. This is maybe also what we talked about before, this aspect of craft.
Yes.
To repair things and think them like really long-term based, and maybe also early ideas of recycling material.
So, for instance, for my exhibition Well-Beings, there was this sofa piece.
Mm-hmm.
And the sofa, the basis of the sofa, I took an old IKEA sofa, very simply, and I added elements together with the help of an upholsterer. We took away the fabric and dyed it with a natural dye and reupholstered the sofa completely. Mm. And it was a very interesting process for me because I had to put away my design artistic ego and saying, no, I want to build a new sofa, you know, want to design my sofa, how it would be. So I found this in-between solution of upcycling an old sofa and then adding elements to kind of change it a little bit, but also from natural materials and stuffing it with wool and things like that.
I never would have thought it was an IKEA sofa before.
Ah.
Never thought so.
And yeah, it's still visible. If you take away all the extra elements, it becomes an IKEA sofa, just dyed very specially. Yeah, so this is a way to say to this. For me, this is a statement as a design. Yeah, and I think the world needs more statements like this. And yeah, it's a little bit different process. We have to put more value in this painstaking effort of maintaining and taking care, you know. That's what caregiving is also.
Mm. Not just for people, but also for objects.
For material.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, that's the ultimate goal, how to reach this understanding that everything is alive and everything needs to be treated with care, because we will only survive all together. And not all together, all the different people together, that for sure, but also all the different species together, but even all the different matter together, to go like into the ultimate depths of it. So this is how deep my understanding of intersectionality goes, just to give you an idea. So how to break down this thinking and, you know, like offer it to people to start seeing things this way, that's my personal challenge as an artist and designer and architect, and I don't care with what kind of means. With the means I have, I'm trying to put this idea out there.
Yes, also really wonderful text by indigenous design theorist Norman Sheehan about this design as an activity, as an active process, where he says that in his eyes, design is to people what nest making is to birds. Yeah. So kind of a very natural act. They rebuild their nests every year or repair them or go to another place, adapt to the new surroundings, weather, everything. And it seems very sustainable. And I really like this perspective because I think also with all this crisis, especially as a young designer, this can be very frightening or frustrating. You're here, you learn some skills already, you want to design new things, you want to produce something, you want to put something out there. But yeah, to see sustainable, interesting alternatives of rethinking this discipline rather than dooming it or like saying it's all bad.
Absolutely. I had students who, after we're learning all of this, they suddenly don't want to do anything anymore. It's like, everything is bad, whatever I do, like, I better sit still and don't do anything.
Yeah.
And I was trying to explain, to bring to them what you just said, that this is essential. We're still human in a way, and this is what we do. And this is a part of a human expression that we cannot rob ourselves away from. It's us not going crazy about it. You know, want to extract all the oil there is in order to keep on creating, you know, we can keep on creating in different ways. And for me, it's not just about sustainability, it's just making good sense of the world around us. Like that, to put everything into a perspective where the pieces of the puzzle connect and they're not floating here and there in disconnection.
Yeah, I really can see this in your work. You are inspired by or directly include very abstract concepts and theory, but then it becomes very graspable and also joyful again. And the form and shape or the process your projects have are not staying in this dystopic or super minimalist way of design, but they seem joyful. And I think this is a very smart way of communicating those topics as well and finding a way to deal with them.
No, thank you for saying it like that. Yeah, I also find so. Because if you really talk about doom all the time, I think that's why people end up, some people end up towards the climate denialism idea. Because they are afraid of all this presentation of the climate collapse as a doom thing. You know, we have to start presenting it as a chance to be more creative again than we are and have something new and exciting project to do for all of us. And this can be also fun. It doesn't we don't have to do it with like, we have to do it otherwise we will all die. Yeah, so how to reclaim this narrative without denying what's really happening and without shying away from having feelings about it that we have to process and we have to acknowledge that they are there.
Yeah, this might be a good moment to talk about a second artwork of yours, a collective process as well, called Hot Stuff, where you also really focus on one small aspect of public life, one small aspect of, yeah, in the end also of climate, because it's about heating, and one small aspect of coming together. Would you like to tell us about this project of yours?
Yeah, so that was a project I did quite some time ago, mm-hmm. back in 2016 in Witten, as part of the Urban School Ruhr, which was part of the Urbane Kunst Ruhr Festival. And Hot Stuff is basically an oven, a rocket mass heater, if you know what I mean. So a rocket mass heater is a type of oven, but that is highly efficient, so it burns very little fuel to heat up a mass of bricks that keep the heat longer stored because of its materiality, just the bricks or earth or whatever it's made out of. And the innovation of the project was to put it in public space. It's usually made for indoor situations.
To heat a flat or a room?
To heat a house, normally, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. More houses house. In the countryside, because you need to have a chimney. Or people use them also to heat greenhouses in colder climates in winter.
Yeah.
And it's a design that comes from the 70s and originated in places like Africa or parts of Latin America, where they use a lot of wood to cook because mm-hmm. they don't have access to any other infrastructure. So this is it's a work about infrastructure essentially, and promoting this alternative infrastructure which burns very little fuel to heat a place for cooking, or yeah. If you extend it with a thermal mass, you can heat a space with it. So mm-hmm. it basically becomes a warm bench. And or a warm bed or whatever you want to build out of it. And then it also, if it's indoors, it keeps the heat in the room longer. But if it's outdoors, it just keeps the heat in its material, the brick. So if you sit on it, you are getting warm. And this was very appealing for me because back then Germany was still colder in the winter.
Yeah, and things have changed.
Yeah, things have changed and they are changing rapidly. But I come from a culture where we also, in Greece, where winters are quite mild and we spent also time outdoors during the winter. So yeah. It was like, how can we build infrastructures to be able to spend sustainably times outdoors in winter and not mm-hmm. put these big heaters that you put in the cafes that consume a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And this design is is an interesting design, although it burns wood. But if you look at the numbers statistically, the energy it uses is far less than any other type of heating. So it's a very good, a very sustainable way to heat even houses.
Mm-hmm. Resourceful.
Yeah, and I wanted to also promote in the region where there is a lot of houses with fireplaces, that maybe instead of a fireplace you should make a rocket mass heater. And because it was in public space, we had to have the local oven builder as a kind of consultant. And he didn't believe it would work because he didn't know this design, which is a very low-tech design. It's just a matter of proportions. It's nothing high-tech in there. And he
There's
didn't
also
know.
A lot of DIY videos, right?
Yes.
It's kind of like open source.
It's an open source phenomena, and people who have businesses to build fire-related infrastructure, they don't know it, which is ridiculous. And he didn't believe it would work, and it worked perfectly, actually, because what it does is that it burns the wood fully instead of leaving material behind, and then it makes more complete burn of the wood, and thus it needs much less wood. And it was really surprising, like we had it for a full day on burning, and it was really surprising how little wood we burned too. And it was warm until the next morning, actually.
Oh, wow.
So it stayed warm during a night outdoors the whole night.
In winter. Let's also talk about the social aspect of it. So this was the material one and infrastructure one, but also I think this can change how people think about their immediate living surroundings to form groups and demand changes in their infrastructures and their neighborhoods to make them more welcoming. And a warm space in winter is also a good starting point for exchange, for people to get into conversation with each other, to make the terrible problems of homeless people in winter a tiny bit smaller, but also maybe for old people who need to rest on a walk for a while, or just everyone who wants to have a warm moment and maybe also some company.
For me, it's also a little bit like what you're doing with the boucheria. But it's a social space to exist beyond consuming something. Mm-hmm. And in public, not only about reading the books that are amazing there and you're offering them so generously for free, but also, this is what you told me when I first came there, is like people can use this space for free.
Mm-hmm.
And just come here and hang out and meet each other without having to buy anything. And this is a very interesting thing. And of course, we have parks and we have benches, but it's also all kind of solo or very small group activities. And there is also nothing to share. While taking care of a fire is a very nice primitive activity that many people are interested in because fire has something cool about it. And something that is building community, it offers something more to do together instead of just sitting somewhere together or next to each other and not talking to each other, because, you know, to maintain a fire you have to communicate a little bit, and this is a good icebreaker, so to say, to have a little bit more neighborhoodly public life. But the project didn't stay long enough, because in the context of Urbana Construir, they only get these temporary permissions.
Yeah.
And it didn't work out. Like, I wanted to donate it to the city as a gift. Maybe somebody from another city will listen to this podcast and will say, yeah, bring it to our city. Maybe here we can help you get the permission to build it long term. Because I would really have liked to see what will happen if you have such an infrastructure and you have also some small organization or Verein or something that takes care of it in a way that can go to people, how you can put off a fire. And there is some caretaking involved, and this is what everybody is afraid of, you know, like participation and caretaking, and it's hard things to get permission for.
Yeah, maybe also because they have a radical possibility. When people start to realize their agency through processes like this.
I mean, it is surely also political, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I really also hope this will find a new home. And at the same time, I think also this image, I saw an image of it online where you took away the structure again. You could still see where it was standing, because it was maybe wet or a bit darker from the fire. And also to leave this trace is such a strong image. And also in social design processes, often we as designers go somewhere, we build something like a community garden, and then we just leave. And leave people with it and make them stewards. But maybe they didn't really chose this role, or maybe they didn't know what they're taking on, and things grow too fast. And then maybe it lasts 1 or 2 years and then, yeah, it kind of breaks and then it becomes more depressing than before. So it can bring some good spirit and quality, but usually for a short time, and then it gets even worse. This is what I sometimes observe, and also why in areas like in Detroit, where a lot of these processes have happened, people have really started to question this and have a much more critical look at socially engaged practices. Luckily, this is important for all of us. And this is why a network like the Design Justice Network has formed. And yeah, there's new guidelines and new thinking about design. But I think this is why I also like this aspect about the oven, to not leave it there. It's also kind of strong moment about the project. And maybe if it finds a new place, then it can be mediated differently from the beginning with a neighborhood or a few people maybe who can make it sustainable.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is what we didn't really find there, because it needs a pre-existing structure. You cannot just go there and put a nail in thing and say people, now you can use this. It needs a pre-existing structure of some sort of community association that they're looking for such projects. And this is where we realize that these structures that do a lot of invisible work are very important. And sometimes they need projects like this, sometimes they have bigger fish to fry. You know, it's all very understandable and it's all okay. You know, we offer what we offer only insofar as it's helpful. To also expand the possibilities of understanding what it could be possible in public space, and that public space is also ours, and it's not just just to pass through or go shopping, because that's what we only do. We just walk to go from place to place or into shops or from an outdoor cafe. This is for me interesting, and it's also like an act of this positive imagination about the future of places where people live together.
So with those two artworks of yours, I think you got a small overview about your way of working and which scale those things can have and which factors return, like thinking about infrastructures and your critical mindset. Then let's talk a bit more about your teaching experience, because now you taught in HFPK in Hamburg for, I think, 6 years. Yeah. And I think it's a real challenge to teach foundation year students. And when you invited me recently to give a small workshop with your students and for this collaboration where your students designed an amazing textile shelf for Bücheria, the neighborhood library I'm part of organizing, and I was very impressed to observe you teaching, to see your student body. And in general, I think both of us have this interest in trying to make things accessible, no matter if it's an artwork or a room or, yeah, also teaching, how we can bring as much accessibility as possible. And also we exchanged about that your students have such different backgrounds, from their age to their upbringing to their interests, and they also really bring different needs. And also how we can make a fruitful learning space for neurodiverse or neurospicy students. So let's continue our brief talk we had about this recently. Like, what is your strategies about this? And maybe you also made realizations what works and what doesn't in the last 6 years. And what did you learn in the process?
Yeah, that's an interesting topic to dive into. And I think all my experience with socially engaged works like Hot Stuff, because there we didn't mention, but we worked with the community where they could help us build the oven, and then we did some events in the oven with them. But a lot of other work I did, I worked with different communities. And working with communities is very interesting because you get usually a very varied spectrum of people. Depends where you are in the world also, but it's a lot of people from, you know, from youngsters to people of older age. And so with a very different background and very different way of seeing the world. And teaching in the art school in Hamburg and HFPK, in a very international school with students from all over the world, and having the possibility to enter the bachelor's of fine arts at a very different ages, which is something that was very foreign to me, because in Greece we finish high school and then we immediately do the exam and then we immediately go to university. So we're all like 18 or 19 and we're all the same age and it's very homogeneous. Here in Germany it's not like this. There were a lot of people with having studied something else before or in different stages of their career in the arts, people who already had the practice and finally decided to formalize it.
An
art practice or sometimes a crafts practice, people with carpentry or ceramic skills, or people coming from medicine or philosophy or economics. And then, of course, the very young people that are still 18 and they just did a bit one. So I think my social engaged practice helped me understanding that actually we don't need to reach all of us a consensus. We just need to create a place where we accept each other's differences, and everybody contributes what they can contribute within this frame that we're all part of, and that's the goal. You know, like, that's much more than enough. And this is also how I work when I work in a communal setup or when I work with participation or the public completing the work. I create a frame, not too strict, but also not too open. And then I invite people to contribute something to fill in this empty frame somehow. So that's one kind of mentality that helped me a lot in creating a class out of all these very different people and with very different needs. We were also talking about the neurodivergency, which I find it learning about neurodivergency really helped me in every social interaction, actually, not just in teaching. I will tell you precisely why, because sometimes you meet people that you cannot understand each other, or that you need to repeat a lot of times things until they get it. Like, I had this problem with the students. I had to repeat things all the time. I was like, why don't they just, you know, write it down once and then remember it? And then I started to understand, some people have ADHD here, or some people have a little bit of different things, that it's just in their nature to forget stuff. And then this makes you also a lot more forgiving. You don't take it personally. It's not because of me. I'm not doing it wrong. It's just that we all have different needs and our brains are differently wired. And then I learned that to treat everybody thinking as if we all are neurodivergent is the best way. You know, like, not take anything for granted, not expect people to remember things, not expect people to be on time, not expect people to know this or that already, and to really take things very slow and repeat things a lot of things often. And
because repetition is also learning, right?
Repetition is also learning. I do a lot of things, this concept of rehearsing things, you know, like kind of workshopping things instead of actually doing them.
Can you be a bit more concrete?
This concept, I learned it from LARPing, this live action role-playing technique.
Ah, cool, yeah.
Which we didn't talk about it, but there was a LARP video in Wellbeings, which I did together with a LARP designer and students of HFBK. We developed it together. But I had done some LARPing before in LARP festivals. And there, actually, the LARP is like a role play without an audience. So you do it only for yourself and for each other. There are no spectators.
Yeah.
You are all participating in the room. And I got really amazed with how these people are leading these workshops, which basically we rehearse the whole LARP before we go into playing it. So we know exactly in part one, this will happen. We test it out a little bit, but quite a lot, actually, quite enough. Then part two, it's all very structured and it's very, it works with rehearsals. So after you finish all the rehearsals, you go into and play the LARP. You have already kind of made up, you know what will come.
Mm-hmm.
And this works, of course, very well for autistic people, you know, not to be in a situation where you don't know what's happening. And I used to not have this in mind in my earlier time of teaching, and still in the very end, when time was very strict and we had to finish stuff, then things were getting messy and things were not working well enough, but I knew it's not because of me, it's or because of the students, it's because we were running out of time, and sometimes we just have to deal with this, and we cannot do everything perfectly. But when there is time, I think the best is to really, you know, you have a presentation, then we really rehearse the presentation before the presentation happens. Or, yeah, this concept of the rehearsal, I found it very, very interesting.
Yeah, especially I really like this notion of rehearsing just for yourself, even if there's no audience. This is really nice.
Yeah. This was really cool, actually, mind-blowing experience. And from the little bit I read about neurodivergency, I also took part of a workshop for professors about neurodivergency that was offered by the HFBK, and the workshop teacher kind of confirmed this for me, that, yeah, this is the neurodivergent teaching model. And also to take things slowly and leave some time. Like for at the HFBK, I contributed one of my cushion, a reproduction of one of the cushion areas of the well-being. And it's in the extended library, and a lot of students go and hang out there and, you know, to kind of rest a little bit. And she was also saying how important places of rest are for neurodivergent people. Actually, I find these things very, very, just very humane of teaching. You know, like if all schools or all universities would be adapted like that, or actually every working place, you know, it's like really, this is really acts of collective self-care when the institution puts some infrastructure that allows for self-care.
Besides the infrastructure, I think it also needs this atmosphere where you are not afraid to talk about your needs. Yeah, maybe you need more time or more rest than some of the other students or teachers. And a lot of art school teachers, I think they also model this kind of life and practice where you always have energy, where you always have very long days from morning till afternoon, and then still go to an exhibition opening and have to be active and informed about everything going on, and where your work is your passion. And so all of this can be very inspiring and fruitful, but at the same time, I know from some of my former colleagues and also some students that this can be maybe a bit threatening to them as well, or they feel like they don't belong, or they will never be like this, or they can only be successful in the system if they adapt to those images. This was also something I find very exciting and special about you and your teaching practice, that you don't seem to adapt to this maybe also show aspect so much, but teach in a more soft, inclusive, vulnerable way, where we can also understand critique differently as a form of care, and maybe not to be crushed directly, which many art school students experience. They just start and they're already crushed. And this can really also close doors and not really create this more open atmosphere in teaching. But now I'm hopefully can close the circle. I think it really takes courage as a professor or as teaching staff to be vulnerable, because it's easier to give this kind of harsh, classic, conventional critique. And we all learned this in like you and I learned this the way we were taught in our studies in architecture and design, and then to still decide to do it differently. And what you said when we talked about this once, what really stuck with me was that you said it's kind of the default mode we learn, like what we learned in our education, and to break away from it again and again, but to make this a decision to still teach in a soft way or vulnerable way and not fall into the default mode. And I was very surprised to hear from you that this also for you is still the default mode and still is an active part of unlearning.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can be a super harsh critic.
Me too.
Yeah, I can be a super harsh critic, and at some point I recognized how much harm not only I did to others, but also to myself, when you internalize this critique as a form of power play. And we all have internalized it to some way or another, and some people cannot really escape this. And I think also because of all this suffering through the climate anxiety, where I really have to learn to be extra nice to myself. It kind of flipped things for me. And I saw that I could only overcome this by being nice, not by being critical. Critique didn't help me there at all. I actually had to be critical for the first time so roughly towards capitalism and the others who put me in this position, being so strict about myself for having all these climate emotions. No, because that's especially as a good student girl, as a girl.
Yeah.
This is something you internalize from a very young age. So, yeah, I learned it with the time and the years. And some students also were not so happy with my soft approach, you know. And they went on to professors that play this power plays of... I'm the professor, I'm the master, and I make my presence in this group very... I put it up on the ladder of hierarchy. And it's not that I took myself away from completely from hierarchy, you know, I wasn't also like hanging out with them in the equal level. This also doesn't fully work.
No, no, this is more like hiding hierarchies. Yeah.
Exactly. So, like, you have to acknowledge that you are anyway in this position in the hierarchy, but how you really, if you embrace it with, like, complete narcissism, or if you are, like, try to deal with it in a way that is constructive, also for me, not only for them, and that I can learn something honest about myself through this process, it's a choice. Yeah, and it depends also how much you understand that you have a choice to make. You know, we repeat what we learned. I also had some moments of re-guessing myself. Am I doing this right? Should I be more strict, more harsh, more this, more that? Because I try to do always positive reinforcement, you know, like giving critique, but through saying, okay, this is not so great, but look at this. Here you've done something amazing. You know, and actually I believe it because there is always something amazing in anything you take courage to do and put out there. People start on very different levels and they come from very different backgrounds. And how can you judge something alone without the context? You cannot.
Yeah.
So by getting to really know the students, then you can really see their real powers. And some, I think quite many of them flourished in this system. And they really took it very honestly. And I hope that they're still working so honestly with themselves. For me, you know, the harshest critic is you yourself. I learned to deal with that and how to kind of keep them company while they're learning to deal with that for themselves. That's the actual work in teaching, I think.
I just saw a really nice video from the poet Ocean Wang. Do you know her?
No.
He's doing amazing poetry and he's teaching poetry as well. And he's talking about his experiences in teaching and that every classroom, school, uni, wherever, a classroom is a room full of hope. And that he, because of this, decided to approach critique differently in the first, I think, 4 to 6 weeks of every semester. So when his students started to write their own first poems, they were not allowed to judge things. They were not allowed to say, this is good, this is bad, this is wrong, but really only describe the works from the others. So they were really practicing seeing and finding words for what they see and hear without any judgment. And at some point, they were allowed to give each other proper feedback and say like, yeah, could you try to do this differently or this part I don't really like. And so how we understand feedback normally, I think. And even if they were allowed to do this, this training and just noting what you see really stuck with them. And this feedback was so much more fruitful and so much more focused on each one's individual work and not on generalizations, like a poem has to be like this, a chair has to be like that, but really on the person and the specific piece. And this is an amazing advice, I think, which we can all maybe incorporate more to really also practice and maybe rehearse, as you said, this form of giving feedback and critique to each other.
Yeah, this sounds really beautiful, actually. Very inspiring. Yeah, and for me, the question is also, you know, what is it so triggering when we see somebody else's work that makes us wanting to give feedback so dramatically? What are the triggers and how to work with these triggers? There is a general tendency towards, against critical thinking. And this is creating very mediocre work or work that's super apolitical,
mm-hmm.
or even in the aesthetic realm, even if we're taking all the politics away and we only talk about aesthetics, it's also not contributing anything new. Yeah, so this is triggering. Sometimes I'm also like losing a little bit my patience with this and understanding for myself why is it triggering me so much. And then making it, giving feedback or critique from a perspective of how it makes me and maybe a possible audience feel and not about this person that did mm-hmm. that. You know, so it's not about putting this responsibility to this person to mm-hmm. know better. To have mm-hmm. known better before putting this mediocre thing out there.
mm-hmm.
But to understand that, oh, okay, this is triggering me. This is triggering something in me. And yes, I have to express that how this makes me feel. But without pointing the finger or rubbing it to the face of this person that they did something unspeakable or completely wrong. And this is, it's a lot about empathy growing. I'm learning how to deal with that. It's all psychological processes in the end, all this feedback, proper mm-hmm. feedback giving. You really have to know yourself quite well.
So after 6 years of teaching in Halfbekar, you're now kind of closed or finished a big chapter and have accompanied tons of students in their way of becoming an artist or a designer and growing and maybe sometimes taking difficult ways as well, but then in the end managing to get through the system of art school. And I'm wondering if you still want to continue teaching or what is your next chapter? Is there already a perspective, something coming up which you would like to share with our audience?
Yeah, as I said, I'm now showing again well-being in Saarbrücken, which I'm very happy to, because this is a really big show with a lot of effort, so I'm mm-hmm. happy to show it a little bit more.
Is it in a gallery or
in it's in the Staatsgalerie.
Okay, Staatsgalerie Saarbrücken.
In Saarbrücken. And then I want to continue my work on climate emotions and their and experiences about it, collective experiences around mm-hmm. them. So I'm happy to have a little bit more time now in my studio to go into the research phase that is a little bit... it's actually, for me, more consuming than the production phase.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, I really do miss the students. I feel like a mama whose children are gone and I'm like, I have this empty nest feeling, mm-hmm. which I'm trying to deal with. It was really amazing to work with the students and with all these people from all these diverse backgrounds and in different moments in their life and to accompany them in these processes of arriving at the art university. So I do hope I will sooner or later will go back into the teaching, and I'm applying for different positions, but this time I would like to find a position that it's a little bit more supporting my particular interest. Yeah, like creating these more different visions about the future and managing climate change all together as a collective or as a community. Which doesn't mean that it cannot involve individual expressions, but yeah, I would like to be able to bring more of that into the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
In this, in the teaching in the foundation course, I had to be very open for what the students had to bring in, because they were the ones who had to find out their personal voice and what motivates them to do art or design. Yeah, so now I would like to teach to a little bit more experienced students, that they have found out that what they are interested in and what I'm interested in is more closer together.
I see, yeah.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Thank
with
you.
Finding a new position like this, Valentina. And I'm really looking forward to see your next artworks, exhibitions, and follow where you move to.
Yeah, thank you so much, Anna. This was a real pleasure. And yeah, come to Saarbrücken for the opening.
Thanks, Valentina.
Hurra, hurra! Ein Design-Podcast der Burg.